Good afternoon from USC's Annenberg Media Center, and welcome to From Where We Are from Annenberg Radio News. It's Thursday, September 20th, 2018, and I'm Charlotte Kim.
And I'm Miranda Myers. Here's your news update. Today, California Governor Jerry Brown signed into law a proposal that will restrict plastic straws at dine-in restaurants. The law is part of a global measure to reduce plastic use and will go into effect on January 1st, 2019. The straw restriction states that restaurants cannot provide straws to customers unless they specifically request them. Any full-service restaurant caught providing plastic straws to guests will be penalized with a $25 fine for each infraction. Annenberg Media spoke to eBay's restaurant in Los Angeles to hear their thoughts on the new straw restrictions.
We actually stopped giving out straws about half a year ago. We haven't seen many customers request for straws if straws are not given to them. It was more for environmental friendliness than financial reasons.
That was Assistant Manager Cody Zhao. The Los Angeles Film Festival opens today. Jia Jun Chen spoke to several filmmakers at the USC Film School to find out why film festivals are important to filmmakers.
USC film student Niharika Nagy says that being invited to a film festival is an affirmation of the filmmaker's talent.
I think if you're invited to a festival, it's a validation of your work, but also it puts you in a position to meet with potential international collaborators and partners that you can continue a conversation with after the festival's over. It's usually pretty good if you're attending.
Nagy says she plans to network at the festival this week.
I think it's really amazing to be able to see all of the films and to find a place to, again, same thing, I guess, in more unofficial capacity, interact with people who come there and, you know, learn more about the industry.
Film student Ella Harris loves film festivals. She says the festivals provide great opportunities to filmmakers looking for distribution.
I think it's great because that's really the baseline of film industry. I think that, you know, especially with the bigger film festivals, companies will come in, production companies will come in to find, you know, new content to distribute, and it's really nice when there is a lot of well-rounded representation in the film and in the film festivals. That means that's the next level of content that's coming out to audiences and people who are just media consumers.
The festival will run from today through next Friday, the 28th. For Annenberg Media, I'm Jiajun Chen.
Mornings aren't getting any easier for middle and high school students. Governor Jerry Brown vetoed legislation today that sought to push school start times to 8:30 or later. The average school start time in California is currently 8:07 a.m. Supporters of the bill cited research that shows delayed start times could result in better grades and attendance. Other research shows that simply going to bed earlier is not a viable solution. Opponents of the bill don't dispute the research, but believe school boards should decide for themselves. The bill was expected to be finalized after passing earlier this month, but opposition from the California Teachers Association caused Governor Brown to veto it. Too many lines, not enough colors. The Los Angeles Metro is expanding, which has them taking a closer look at the system's naming scheme. Taylor Begley has the story.
With 8 new rail and bus lines opening in the next 10 years, Metro spokesperson Rick Jagger says there needs to be a more consistent approach to naming the lines. He says that combining colors with numbers or letters will make it easier for riders to identify the route they are looking for.
Implementation probably won't occur for a couple of years and may coincide with the opening of either the Crenshaw LAX line in late 2019 or the Regional Connector line in downtown Los Angeles in late 2021.
Metro rider Eric Gonzalez says a change is needed as colors will start to look too similar.
And then they'll confuse red and pink, and like, you know, they'll just get closer and closer to each other, so they'll become like indistinguishable. For the long run, yeah, they should definitely change them to like numbers and letters and stuff.
USC student Elise Ellis, who rides the Metro to her internship, has experienced other naming systems living on the East Coast.
I'm from DC, and I think the New York Metro is a little confusing because of the numbers and colors thing and letters, so I think the color system is a lot easier.
Ellis says she thinks it will be a big change for most riders and stressed the importance of Metro's efforts to inform the public of the changes. Jagger says they have a plan.
We'll use all forms of both digital and traditional media outlets and community relations and meetings and public hearings and all of that type of thing to get the word out.
The Metro Board of Directors still has to approve the plan. Jagger says details should be available by the end of the year, including a cost estimate for the project. For Annenberg Media, I'm Taylor Begley.
Plans to demolish the Times Mirror Square complex have been put on hold. The Los Angeles Cultural Heritage Commission recommended that the complex be given monument status. The LA Times worked out of the complex beginning in 1935, but recently moved to a new location in El Segundo. The LA Department of City Planning wants to preserve the building for its architectural and historical values. For now, developers and preservationists will have to wait until a decision is made on its monument status. No scanning, no bagging, no checking out. A new fleet of Amazon stores will allow shoppers to make purchases by just walking out. Brooke Thames has more.
Amazon is looking to take speed and convenience to the next level by cutting cashiering out of the process in thousands of new stores. Bloomberg News reports that Amazon plans to open as many as 3,000 Amazon Go stores across the United States by 2021. Amazon Go provides ready-to-eat food and a variety of grocery products. But what makes them different from your typical grocery store is that computer vision technology and sensors track what items you pick up. When you walk out, your Amazon account is charged for the items you leave with. Gil Appel is an assistant professor of marketing at USC, whose research focuses on digital markets. While Amazon is moving toward a future without cashiers, Appel says human interaction may not be obsolete.
What I'm hearing repeatedly is that people need this human interaction. You see, you have those cashierless places also in like Ralph's and any other store that you can go and scan and leave. But you still see people using the other cashiers because some people need the human interaction. Sometimes you have a question, you need something, and that person might help you.
Amazon Go stores could pose a threat to traditional convenience retailers like 7-Eleven, where customers must wait in line to have items manually checked out. Appel says traditional convenience and grocery stores may still be able to compete.
A store can work their like human approach. We're there for you. We're not like this cold machine that you go in and out and grab what you need. And you see some stores try to do this, especially the higher end, like Trader Joe's and Whole Foods, trying to build more on customer appreciation and stuff like that.
Some customers don't see their interactions with cashiers as necessary. Dan Einazazan is a Trader Joe's shopper.
Personally, I think it makes shopping a much better experience for anyone because everyone hates long lines while they're waiting in any sort of line. No matter what it is, people just hate lines. So people can just like walk out and get, you know, charged without having to wait. I think it's beneficial, but on the other hand, with technology, there's less and less of human interaction that goes on. There are positive and negatives to it, but obviously I think the positives override the negatives, and I don't think a social interaction between a person and a cashier really defines how social they are and how social they should be.
Right now, Amazon Go stores are located in Seattle and Chicago. If the plan to expand these stores goes forward, LA could expect to see a few. For Annenberg Media, I'm Brooke Thames.
It's 9 minutes after the hour. I'm Miranda Myers.
Coming up on From Where We Are, street vendors are subject to a new law. On today's Root Source, we take a look at the history of the word serendipity.
Serendipity is when you make happy and unexpected discoveries by accident. The word was coined in 1754 by the English art historian Horace Walpole. Wopo came up with the word after reading a fairy tale called The Three Princes of Serendip. In a letter to his friend, he described how the main characters of the story were always making discoveries, by accidents and sagacity, of things they were not in quest of. In other words, they stumbled upon nice things accidentally, and that's serendipity. For Annenberg Media, I'm Manjia Chen.
The Hispanic community has historically had the lowest voter turnouts. A local immigrant rights organization is confident this can change during this year's midterm elections. Jesus Alvarado has a story.
The Coalition for Humane Immigrant Rights of Los Angeles, or CHIRTLA, wants to get young Latinos to the polls this November.
I got myself involved because I know I can make a difference.
That's 19-year-old high school graduate Manuel Lopez. He was recruited by Wise Up, the high school branch of CHIRTLA.
What Wise Up does is it gathers high school students and trains them to be the leaders of their own community.
Every election season, CHIRTLA recruits young Latinos to hit the streets and register other young Latinos to vote.
It's personal to them. You know, they're fired up. They want to do more. They want to talk to voters. They want to have an impact in their community.
That's Diana Collin. She's a civic engagement director for CHIRTLA.
You know, there's still time to register votes. There's still time to update your voting information, your address, if you want to register to vote by mail, if you want to change your party, if you want to request your materials in language, there's still time for all of that.
And that's why Lopez is volunteering with CHIRTLA, canvassing different neighborhoods in LA.
I want to spread the word out to my fellow youth so they can make a difference within their own communities and to help each other out because we are the future.
USC is making their own efforts to increase voter turnout by hosting a National Voter Registration Day by Tommy Trojan on September 25th. For Annenberg Media, I'm Jesus Alvarado.
It's time for Match Volume. Each week, we meet a newsmaker or thought leader in a conversation curated by the USC Annenberg podcast, Match Volume. Today, we hear from the new director of the Annenberg Media Center, Professor Christina Bellantoni. Bellantoni has been a journalist for more than 20 years as reporter, editor, producer, and analyst. She's reported on politics from the local level to the White House and covered four presidential elections. Her resume includes political editor at the PBS NewsHour, editor-in-chief of Roll Call, and assistant managing editor at the LA Times. Robert Tyler Walker asked Christina Bellantoni about coming to USC to teach and to direct the Annenberg Media Center.
How did you leave, you know, the newsroom and find yourself in academia?
So it was kind of a roundabout process. Willow and I had our first conversation in February, and she kind of raised the idea of coming to Annenberg. And it wasn't something that had ever occurred to me, but the more I started to think about it, the more I liked the idea of, first and foremost, working with students who I find very inspiring and also critical to my industry and also, I think, the health of democracy in America and globally. Overall, the fields of communication and journalism are just, you know, really pivotal to that. So I started to think about, well, do I have something to contribute? And I've always been a leader in newsrooms. I've been very lucky to rise fairly quickly for my age. But to be able to think about this crisis that I think we are in right now in this moment in journalism, to be able to think about that not actually being steeped in the crisis of being in a newsroom was really appealing. And so then talking further about, you know, what I could potentially do at Annenberg and learning more about the Media Center, which, you know, is a newsroom, a classroom, an incubator, really felt to me like I have something to contribute. And it's totally different, and I kind of like the idea that I'm nervous about it. It's not something I have completely locked down or that I'm sure how it's going to go. And that's a good thing, because I think I can learn just as much as I will be teaching.
What do you hope you can prepare the students in the Media Center for? Because you talked about, you know, this media landscape we're in today. It's so volatile and pivotal, and there's all this controversy going on. So, you know, what can you
the era of being called fake news, if you will. Yeah, I think that I can help the students really understand what it is like to be a journalist in the trenches. I've done every single form of reporting there is. I've knocked on doors. I've done data reporting. I've done grunt unpaid research. I have been on the campaign plane with presidential candidates. I have been at press conferences in the White House. I've been in front of a camera, behind a camera, a radio host. And so all of those different things that I've been able to do, I think I can really share what that experience was like for me and help them kind of see, you know, first and foremost, is this a career they want to go into? If it is, how they can succeed in it. And I think also just as important, decide it's not for them. Hopefully, I love this profession. I want as many people to be involved in it as possible. And I want as many broad voices from as many different types of backgrounds and places and cultures as possible. But at the same time, also recognizing like it is a difficult business and seeing if you want to being a reporter, or maybe you want to be the person to develop the next really important delivery system for journalism. Maybe you're the person that can help newspapers make money. Maybe you're a future publisher. So there's so much more to it than just going out and being a reporter and telling stories. And also, we are in a very competitive business right now where telling a story is not that simple. Anyone can be a journalist at this moment because of the phone we have in our pocket or in our purse. And that's something that I really hope that the students are learning as much digital skills as they possibly can, because that's what they're going to need to compete in the job market.
You talked about diverse voices in the newsroom, and I know you've worked in the newsroom, and I'm sure you've seen the lack of diversity. How important is that when you look at the Media Center and this incoming class of that diversity you saw out there?
Yeah, I was really impressed by that. I mean, obviously, you're just judging it on the faces you see. I haven't gotten to know everyone. I'm a big believer in where you come from and what you bring to the table as a philosophy is just as important as, you know, the color of your skin or how you were raised. I think all of those things are really critical. One thing I've seen in newsrooms is that a certain similar type of person tends to hold similar jobs. Some of it is just history makes that so. There's a lot of people between the ages of 55 and 75 in newsrooms who happen to be white men because those are the people who were very successful at the times when they were rising in their careers. But you also need to have people that are from every part of every place on this planet. You also need people that have diverse viewpoints. I think it's really important to think about cultural diversity, whether that's the type of religion a person has or their beliefs, because they just come to the table with a different perspective. They can see things that another person with a different background might not see. And in addition to, I personally think that having people of color and women and young people in newsrooms is really critical to the health of our industry, because that is the future of this country and this planet.
Do you kind of want to bring more of a political aspect? Not, you know, picking sides, but getting these young journalists more interested in politics, because that is such a big part of journalism today.
One of my fundamental goals as a journalist has always been to help people understand their government and the human beings who are interacting in their government and making the decisions that affect them. And the presidential campaign is always the flashy thing. Everyone wants to stand in a cornfield in Iowa as a journalist, right? I've done it. It is really exciting. But you know what is just as important? The county supervisor race right here in Los Angeles County. These congressional races that are going to decide if Democrats control the U.S. House of Representatives or the Republicans control it. That's so critical. The next governor of California, you know, yes, we have a sort of understanding of who's going to win that race, but we don't know for sure. And the issues that they talk about are driven by the people. And so here's where the journalism and communication part of it. Students here in Annenberg can help drive those conversations. They can say, these are the issues we care about. We're going to ask about it. This is what our audience wants to know. And so, yes, I would like to do a lot of political work out of the Media Center, but I think it's also about what does the audience want? If the student audience who's reading the work, reading and watching the work that comes out of the Media Center and Annenberg Media, says we want to know more about these congressional candidates, then we should give them more about the congressional candidates. If they want to know more about the student body elections, we need to increase our coverage of that. There's already a lot of work being done on that, and I think we can do more.
Christina Bellantoni, the new director of the Annenberg Media Center, with Robert Tyler Walker on this week's segment of Match Volume. To hear more of Match Volume's long-form interviews, visit uscannenbergmedia.com. The popular gay dating app Grindr has launched a new campaign called Kinder Grindr. The aim is to combat discrimination and encourage more positive behavior among the app's users. Jesse Ryan reports.
The Kinder Grindr campaign comes 2 months after Sinakine Kiyodara, an Asian-American man, announced that he would bring a class action lawsuit against Grindr for racial discrimination. He was offended by user profiles containing hate speech such as no Asians or not interested in Asians. Since its creation in 2009, some users have complained that Grindr's design promotes toxic masculinity and facilitates transphobia and racism. Jared Majika is a junior at the University of Southern California. He acknowledged that while the ugliness is not often directed at him, he does see it on the app.
People put in their Grindr profiles like no fat people, no femmes, no Asians, no black people, no Latinos, no like all these different like qualifiers saying like I don't want to see that kind of person. So while the discrimination hasn't been targeted to me, I have seen it because within people's bios they're just like I want someone who is masculine or I want someone who is a top or I want someone who is this or that.
Grindr users now have to follow stricter community guidelines. They can no longer use profile language that is discriminatory against others. And individuals who engage in bullying or harassment will be banned from the app. Grindr will also release a series of videos to raise awareness of sexual racism, body shaming, transphobia, HIV stigma, and femme shaming. A main goal of Kinder Grindr is to encourage more positive language in user profiles, says Grindr's corporate communications director, Landon Zumwalt.
We want to know what you are into instead of the negative aspect of what you're not, because we don't want to be excluding people and their experiences from, you know, the general user. We want people to, you know, embrace a more inclusive attitude toward the community at large and engage with people that they might otherwise not have done.
While Kinder represents Grindr's efforts towards making the app experience more inclusive, it will likely not eliminate all bad behavior, says Grindr user and USC junior Jared Majika.
I don't want to say that it's a false promise, but I read an article about it and someone was like, I don't think this Kinder initiative can really change like the underlying problem because it is like underlying based in like transphobia or based in like internalized homophobia or in racism, and these kind of problems like don't just go away because the app changes. And it is much more of like a structural, infrastructural, societal problem.
For Annenberg Media, I'm Jesse Ryan.
A new law will change the way state officials file, promote, and support street vendors. Hala Oscar has a story.
California Governor Jerry Brown has enacted the Safe Sidewalk Vending Act, which will authorize the city of Los Angeles to establish permit programs for street vendors. This law will continue to allow pedestrians, tourists, and locals to enjoy multicultural foods and merchandise. According to city officials, there are over 50,000 operating street vendors in Los Angeles. Carlos Cecilio, a fruit stand vendor on 30th Street, works at one of them. With 3 years of vending experience and long work hours from 8:30 in the morning until 5:30 in the evening, he works to support his family and USC students. Cecilio says he tries to make his food as good and as hygienic as he can for USC students. The law will limit the criminal prosecutions and sentences that vendors may have received in the past due to old rulings. It is an act of support for the work and entrepreneurship of immigrants and low-income families, even just outside our campus walls. Cecilio sells fruit for a living, but he receives more than just money in return. He says he has made many friends, both young and old. While purchasing carne asada fries or corn on the cob may just temporarily satisfy our taste buds and stomachs, it demonstrates lasting support and endorsement for the hard-working men and women in the streets of Los Angeles. For Annenberg Media, I'm Hala Oscar.
International students are more vulnerable to telephone scams, according to the Department of Public Safety. Emily Fuller has a story.
USC's Assistant Chief of Public Safety, David Carlisle, says the more than 11,000 international students enrolled at USC might not be aware of the common tricks criminals use in the U.S. to scam students through the phone.
One of the common scams that foreign students are victims of is they'll receive a phone call from somebody claiming to be from the government. They may claim that there's a problem with their student visa or some other issue surrounding immigration, and they'll ask the student, the innocent student, to send money in the form of a fine. And sometimes they've talked students into sending them gift cards.
In the past, students have sent thousands of dollars to scammers.
It is really sad when you find out that an international student has given up $5,000 in a scam that has no legitimacy.
Alex Lee is one of the many international students at USC who have experienced this. Lee has received automated phone calls claiming to be from the Chinese embassy. He said his uncle taught him what to do when he was being scammed.
So he told us if any one of us receive like a phone call like this, we should like hand out and just like leave it alone. Don't reply or do nothing about this.
Some students say that scammers will even contact their family in their home country. Christine Wu, a Chinese graduate student studying economics, has had to warn her family about these scammers.
I will tell them if you receive this kind of message, you just contact me first, and we will confirm it together, yeah.
Carlisle says international students should contact DPS if they have any questions or think they're being scammed. For Annenberg Media, I'm Emily Fuller.
Have you ever watched a movie and thought, that looks like USC? In today's Trojan Tale, Sophie Marie Prime tells us about some of the hundreds of movies and TV shows that have been filmed at USC.
You've seen Alumni Park dozens of times while running to class. If you look closely, you'll see Bovard Auditorium, Doheny Library, and other campus spots in some of your favorite movies and TV too. Since the 1930s, USC has stood in for fictitious colleges, real universities, and as a familiar background to students, alumni, and Trojan fans. In recent years, there's one show that's recognizable because of its award-winning cast and creator.
Right now we have How to Get Away with Murder is a recurring show here, and they established the front of the PE building as Middleton University.
That's Tori Daves, director of the campus filming department.
Shonda Rhimes is one of our alums. She's the producer for all of the Shondaland shows, so that's How to Get Away with Murder and For the People and Scandal and Grey's Anatomy.
Filming here at USC is so common that there's an entire department dedicated to working with film crews. And according to Daves, a lot of the folks that work on or run those shoots are Trojans.
Just about every single show that comes here has at least one USC alum on it. It could be the producer or director, it could be the cable pullers, it could be, you know, the grips or gaffers. It's such a wide range. Typically, just about every single show has a USC alum on it, and we love it.
Lots of those alumni projects are titles you'd probably recognize, like Forrest Gump and The Social Network. For The Social Network and lots of other movies, USC has stood in for real and fake universities, but rarely is USC itself.
Going back to The Graduate, we played Berkeley. For Gilmore Girls, the daughter went to Yale, and so we played Yale. For Legally Blonde, we played Harvard.
Totally look the part.
But more often than not, USC portrays fictitious schools.
Because if it gets played as an actual school, the production company will have to get the approval rights from the school to use their name and use their logos and all of that.
So next time you're watching a classic movie or popular TV show, look out for your alma mater. If you're thinking, hey, I've seen that brick building before, or that looks familiar, chances are you're right. Chances are it was filmed at USC. For Annenberg Media, I'm Sophie Marie Prime.
That's it for From Where We Are Today. Today's show is produced by Savannah Robinson. We had help today from Sasha Urban, Nick Kaufman, and Robbie Aronson. Selena C. Reynolds is our board operator. The theme music was composed by Derek Renfro. Subscribe to From Where We Are on iTunes and follow us on Twitter and Facebook at Annenberg Media. I'm Charlotte Kim.